Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. All but two Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives vote to approve the rules guiding the impeachment inquiry of President Trump, and both of New Hampshire's representatives vote in favor. As of this week, candidates for the first of the nation primary can officially start filing to put their names on the ballot, and a few stop by Concord to make it official. And the candidates for mayor of Manchester debate ahead of next week's election. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments, send them to us by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today, and you can find that video by going to Facebook and searching for NHPR Exchange. Again, that's all one word, NHPR Exchange. Before we get into the analysis portion of the show, we want to check in with Representative Annie Custer, who cast a vote in favor of the rules guiding the impeachment inquiry into President Trump yesterday. She's on the line with us now. Welcome, Representative Custer.
Good morning, Peter. Great to be with you.
Glad to have you. So tell us, why did you vote in favor of these rules?
Well, I think it's so important that the American people see this live, that they can watch the hearings on television and reach their own conclusions. The stage that we've been in this investigation of the president's actions have been closed-door depositions. And they're done that way for a specific purpose. But now I think it's very important to bring the evidence to the American people. What we're experiencing and what we're witnessing is an abuse of power by the President of the United States. He has put our country at risk in terms of our security, and he has betrayed his oath of office. That we need to gather the evidence to demonstrate that, and every American needs to reach their own conclusion on that.
Regarding the closed-door depositions, Republicans have complained about their level of access to materials related to the witnesses speaking in the basement to investigators. How much access have you had to those materials?
I have not, because I don't serve on the committees, but the Republicans do serve on the committee. So there are 105 members of Congress, roughly evenly divided of Republican and Democrat, who have participated in that investigatory process because they've been assigned to those committees. And I should say, Peter, this is a red herring. They have had full access to not only the documents, but to the witnesses. Half of the questioning has been done by the Republican members. And another thing the American people should understand, we still have at least a dozen or so Republicans who are choosing not to participate. They have the authority to be in the room for those depositions, and they've chosen not to. So I just think it's important for everyone to know this has been a completely fair and equal process. The Republicans have been asking the questions. They've been reviewing the documents. Their legal counsel has access to all the information.
Do you think that these rules that were voted on yesterday ensure the kind of transparency that the president's supporters were asking for?
Yes. This is the irony of the Republicans voting no yesterday. This vote that they've been requesting for the past several weeks. And they're someone used the analogy of the book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, because what happened is that they were requesting that this process have open hearings. They were requesting that we take this vote on the procedure. But each time we agreed to their request, they moved the bar as to what they're looking for. So the vote that we took yesterday will create a very transparent process. It has more protections for the president and the Republicans than previous procedures in investigations due to impeachment.
What will you be looking for once you have greater access to information?
Well, the kind of testimony that's already been coming out, we have been seeing the statements of these witnesses essentially demonstrating that the president was withholding military aid to our ally, Ukraine. Ukraine is in a position where they are fending off incursion by the Russians. The U.S. Congress voted virtually unanimously, very strong votes in both the House and the Senate, to send military aid to Ukraine. It's a fledgling democracy that we feel very strongly is our ally and needs our support. And the president made a decision to withhold the aid, it appears to withhold a meeting in the White House with the new president of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky. And it was because he was seeking, the president was seeking, essentially assistance with his political campaign. He was asking Ukraine to initiate an investigation of the family of Vice President Biden. And we feel that that's inappropriate and that it's an abuse of power and it's a betrayal of his oath of office.
With phrases like abuse of power and things that especially the presidential candidates have been saying about Trump, that essentially he broke the law. Are you confident with statements floating out there like that, that the president can get a fair trial going forward?
Yes, absolutely. The trial stage will be in the United States Senate. As you know, and the American people know, the Republicans control the Senate, so Mitch McConnell will control that trial. I hope that the American people will get a fair trial, but I have no doubt that the president will get a fair process.
What role, if any, do you think the Mueller report plays in this whole process?
We are focused on the investigation of this incident related to Ukraine, which was not covered in the Mueller report. There are separate lawsuits that pertain to evidence, a more clear record. Congress never received an unredacted record from the Mueller report. So there could be developments down the road. There are also lawsuits related to the president's investments in Deutsche Bank, the president's So there are other issues that are remain, but this impeachment investigation is very tightly focused on what we know, because the president himself has been very clear about this phone call, that he has not objected to it, and so we're starting with that process. And I expect that that's the direction that this will go.
One of the criticisms that Republicans have had is that Democrats have been anxious to impeach the president since they became the majority in the House. And as a result, House lawmakers, they say, are neglecting issues that have greater impact on people's daily lives. What would your response be to that criticism?
Well, two parts. It's a very frustrating and I would say inaccurate. First of all, number one, we have five committees that are doing the investigation, as is our duty under the Constitution. But we have 13 committees that have been working very hard since January. We have passed close to 400 pieces of legislation, important, significant issues about lowering the cost of health care, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, addressing the issue of climate change and renewable energy, addressing issues that impact people's everyday lives. They've been historically bipartisan issues. The Violence Against Women Act was one of the very early bills that we passed way back last winter. All of these bills are sitting on McConnell's desk, and the Senate absolutely refuses to take any vote on substance issues that impact everyday people. And I think that this is all they've got. They have no, first of all, they have no substantive defense. In fact, none of my colleagues yesterday even tried to defend the president. It was all about the process. And second of all, they know that our policies are more popular with the American people. They know that the cost of health care is too high. They know that prescription drugs are too expensive. And they know that we're getting the work done.
Representative Custer, what can the public expect to see now with respect to the impeachment inquiry? Will we see live hearings on television? Will we get to read transcripts of depositions? What should we look for next as the general public?
All of that.
All of that. And will it come out soon? Are we talking this week, next week? When do you think?
Not next week, because there will be another round of depositions. But I expect that this process will start before Thanksgiving, and it will continue into December. And let me say, Peter, because this is very important, nobody came to Congress to impeach the president. And this was a very somber day yesterday. We are distressed that the president has put the country in this position, but we have a clear obligation under the Constitution. And one of the most powerful things I've read recently is the statement, the essay by Alexander Hamilton of what type of person would threaten our democracy and why they included the impeachment procedure in the Constitution. So this is a very serious time, and I have faith in the American people. I have not prejudged the evidence. I feel that we need to understand how to protect our democracy and to bring the American people along with us. So the public hearings, the documents from the transcripts are going to be very, very important, and I hope your listeners will participate and be in touch with us as they have been.
Well, thank you very much. Representative Annie Custer, we appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Let's turn now to Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, regular guest here on the Roundup. Dean, you've been listening in. Your thoughts on Representative Custer's comments?
Yes. Well, just to be clear, what we saw yesterday was a vote to formalize the rules that are going to govern the public portion of the impeachment inquiry that's been underway. The House Intelligence Committee, that's Adam Schiff's committee, will continue to take the lead on that in public. They'll issue a report. They'll release the transcripts from the closed-door depositions. It'll then go to the Judiciary Committee once House Intelligence issues a report. And then Judiciary, that's the Gerald Nadler-chaired committee, would then decide on whether or not to recommend articles of impeachment. That would go to the floor of the House. You need a majority in the House to impeach. Then, as Congresswoman Custer mentioned, you go to the Senate for the trial, and you would need two-thirds of senators, 67 senators, to remove the president, which is certainly a tall order, given that Republicans control the Senate. So, you know, my biggest takeaway from all of this yesterday is that really both parties were quite happy with how unified their caucuses were on the vote. So Democrats were very concerned that they might lose a number of Democrats for electoral reasons if they're in Republican-leaning districts. You know, 2018, Democrats picked up a lot of seats in districts where Trump had won in 2016. So Democrats were concerned that there might be a number of defections and that would undercut the inquiry. They only lost two, one in New Jersey and one in Wisconsin, and both of those individuals are in Republican-leaning districts. And on the other side, Republicans were quite happy at how unified their caucus was. No Republicans voted in favor of the rules package. So the final vote was 232 to 196. So each caucus is where they wanted to be going into that. The downside to this is if you look at other recent impeachment inquiries, we certainly have the Clinton example and the Nixon example. You know, for Clinton, 31 Democrats voted in favor of opening the inquiry. Only five voted for impeachment in the House. But nonetheless, you had more Democrats voting in favor of an inquiry, whereas this time you had zero Republicans voting in favor of the inquiry. And then for Nixon, it was a strong bipartisan support to open the inquiry. Mm-hmm. So we're in a very divided period of government. You know, there's a debate about how problematic it would be to have a president impeached along a purely partisan divide. And then we go to the trial in the Senate. And, you know, to me, what I heard last night from both parties is they're dug in. Democrats are full steam ahead. Republicans are, this is a sham, it's a witch hunt, all the things we've heard President Trump say. And the reporting was that President Trump was actually quite pleased that no Republicans defected and voted in favor of those rules. So that both parties are dug in. It's just a reflection of where we are politically in the country, and I think it's going to be a very divisive public set of hearings. I've talked to Democrats who all say, well, you know, there's new stuff coming out every day, and the American public will see, and Congresswoman Custer talked a little bit about letting voters see and make up their own minds, citizens make up their own minds, but the framework of this partisan divide, I think, is going to make it very challenging for everybody to get through.
All right. Well, this is a story that we're going to be following across NHPR's programs today through the weekend and at NHPR.org. Listeners, do check in there for the latest updates. Some other news regarding the 2020 presidential primary that I want to cover before the break, and I also want to talk to NHPR's Casey McDermott about this. Casey, welcome. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the filing period opened today for candidates who want to be on the ballot for New Hampshire's first in the nation primary. A lot of them either have or plan to go to Secretary of State Bill Gardner's office and hand over $1,000 to make it official. Now, Casey, they don't have to go in person, do they? But they often do. Why do they?
No. So the filing period opened Wednesday. It will stay open for another 2 weeks. And this is kind of a rite of passage for people running for president in New Hampshire. It affords them an opportunity to kind of show people that they are doing things the New Hampshire way, that they're going through the steps to put their name on the ballot, that they're shaking hands with Secretary of State Bill Gardner, that they're coming into the State House, a public building where a lot of people can kind of come and go as they please and interact with New Hampshire voters along the way. But it also serves a purpose of being in many ways an important photo op for the candidate. We have a lot of photos in our own archives, a lot of other news organizations do, of everyone from former President Barack Obama to President Donald Trump to, you could go kind of down the line of almost anyone in history who's been in the White House in the last few decades has had to go through Bill Gardner's office on their way there. I should say, as you mentioned, people don't necessarily have to file in person. For example, former President Bill Clinton sent his wife.
Donald Trump's gonna send Pence.
So it's not required that you do it in person. People can send a surrogate, but if you file on the last day, so the procrastinators, they do have to file in person.
Okay, and that day would be November 15th, yeah. Right?
Yes.
Friday, November.
Yeah.
It's $1,000. You pay $1,000. You sign some paperwork, and you're on the ballot, which is why we get these New Hampshire primaries where there are 25 Republicans and 25 Democrats on the ballot, even though we only talk about a much smaller number of major candidates.
So among those who stopped by in person this week was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He filed, he spoke to reporters, and he also held a rally, a little miniature rally, right, where he spoke to his supporters. And here is a bit of what he had to say when he was here in Concord.
I suspect that by the time we are finished with this campaign, when Election Day comes to New Hampshire, we'll have done more events in more communities than any other candidate.
Casey, your impression of Senator Sanders and his visit?
Yeah, so I think the kind of short takeaway from his visit was that he was coming to express his gratitude to the people of New Hampshire for, I'm paraphrasing him here, but basically showing people that his ideas were electable by delivering a pretty substantive win here in 2016 over Hillary Clinton in the primary. And then he pointed out that, this was his first primary win. He went on to win in a number of other states, won millions of votes nationwide. So he said that, he owed a debt of gratitude to people in New Hampshire for being the first to really make their voices heard about the ideas that he was running to represent. But at the same time, I think he's cognizant of the fact that 2016 was a very different race than 2020, and that there are a number of other people running this time around. There are other candidates who have adopted some of the ideas that he helped to popularize in 2016 and in the years since. And so he said he's not taking anything for granted. And that's what you heard in that clip, was him stressing the amount of time that he's putting in the state, the amount of grassroots organizing that his campaign is doing. And I think that they are really trying to make sure that they don't get, for lack of a better term, kind of lazy or entitled because of the victory that they got in 2016.
Another candidate candidate to visit this week was South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He became the first big-name candidate to file paperwork. There were others, which we covered at NHPR.org. So after filing in Gardner's office, he stopped for a quick chat with political reporter, frequent Roundup guest Paul Steinhauser. And Buttigieg spoke about how being openly gay will affect his campaign.
I think the way to get past it is for voters to have a clear sense of what's at stake in their lives based on who the president is, in the same way that I was able to get reelected with 80% of the vote in Indiana during the governorship of Mike Pence after coming out. I believe the American people will, at the end of the day, settle this question based on who they think is going to be the best president to serve them and make their lives better. I think that the biggest thing that's on the minds of voters is whether they're getting paid enough, whether they're going to be able to get health care, how they're going to save for retirement. Serving up an answer to that, I think, is how we can get past a lot of old prejudices.
Paul Steinhauser speaking with Pete Buttigieg in the echoey halls of the State House. Dean Spiliotis, your thoughts.
And Buttigieg also did a rally outside as well. That's becoming kind of standard for the major party candidates. And, you know, it's interesting to hear him reflect on being an openly gay candidate for president. If you think back a little over 10 years ago when Barack Obama ran the first time, the default position for Democrats, including Obama, was civil unions. So we weren't even at gay marriage yet. And obviously, Mayor Buttigieg is married. We've come a long way in 11 years. You know, this is the kind of thing. There's some polling data on how people feel about the possibility of having a president who is openly gay. It's very hard to gauge because people aren't necessarily open about their true preferences on a question like that. It seems to be much less of an issue than it once was. But in a general election, it's hard to tell for sure because there's significant variation across the country. You know, the way this race is shaping up, it's really could be a potentially interesting, you know, pre-primary and caucus window. Elizabeth Warren seems very strong in Iowa. Bernie Sanders in a new CNN UNH poll in New Hampshire is leading at 21%. And Joe Biden is very strong in South Carolina. So you could end up with these three big contests right off the bat where each one of those top three takes a state, and then we go on to Super Tuesday. And the wild card here is Mayor Pete to some extent. He has now moved kind of very comfortably into fourth place in most of these polls. He may even be in third place in Iowa in one poll, I can't recall. But so Buttigieg is in the mix. Everybody else has kind of dropped down 5% or lower. So this could take a while to sort out who the nominee is going to be.
Casey.
I think just building on what Dean said there, it's also worth noting that there are a fair number of people who said that they haven't made up their minds yet.
Yeah.
So it's you know, we still have a ways to go before the primary.
Yeah, like 60%
wherever.
In New Hampshire,
yeah. So according to that recent UNH poll that you cited, about 57% of likely New Hampshire Democratic primary voters said they're still trying to decide as of this month. And to put it into perspective, there were about 47% of the same said that they were still trying to decide at this point ahead of the 2016 primary. So it's not necessarily a huge difference there. I think that this is pretty normal. I think that, you know, those of us in the media like to sometimes kind of anoint a front runner or get a sense of, oh, these are the top candidates. These are not the top candidates. But we really have to kind of check ourselves and remember that the voters still have to decide. There's still a lot of vetting that's going to happen between now and whenever the primary is.
Certainly. The primary is months away. We've got a lot more to cover
in
the meantime. A few months, yes.
February 11th right now.
Okay,
so,
tentatively,
three
yes,
months,
of course.
3 months or
so. So anyway, watch NHPR.org. We're going to be covering the candidates as they come into file and as they say more about their policy positions so that voters can make up their minds by getting the best information possible. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Still to come, we'll talk about the Manchester mayoral race with NHPR Sarah Gibson. She'll join us. We'll also talk about the candidate forums that we've had this week with Elizabeth Warren and Tom Steyer. So stay tuned for that. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday on The Exchange, a look at where the presidential candidates stand on healthcare policy. Right now, though, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. And Casey, wanted to ask you about Elizabeth Warren, because you participated, along with Laura Kanoy, in the latest in our Presidential Candidate Forum series with Elizabeth Warren. You got a chance to ask her a lot of questions. Broadly speaking, though, what's your big takeaway from having had that conversation with
her? So this takeaway is informed by kind of the overarching takeaway that a lot of people have been following with Senator Warren's campaign lately. And it was that, you know, she still was speaking at that point in very broad terms about her plan to transition to Medicare for all. I should say, though, actually, just before I came in the studio this morning, her campaign put out a proposal for how they plan to pay for Medicare for All. So that's online. That's on NPR, has full coverage of that. So I'll let them take the reins on that. But I do think that it's worth noting that she was very careful to, not suggest that middle class taxes are going to go up, to talk about it instead in terms of the overall costs of the healthcare system, which is, I think, something that both her and Senator Sanders, also another outspoken proponent of a Medicare for All system, have been careful to do, so that it doesn't just get kind of framed in terms of, oh, your taxes are going to go up, oh, your taxes are going to go down, but also making sure that people understand more broadly all of the costs that are wrapped up in paying for healthcare right now.
So she's interested in not just how are we going to pay for this expensive system, it's how are we going to make this expensive system less expensive.
Right, right. That, but then also I thought what was interesting about the plan that she put out today was that she, at the very end of it, said that she plans to propose a transition plan that will account for, among other things, how to bridge the gap for people who are struggling right now financially because of healthcare, but then also how to take into account concerns from people who work in the healthcare industry, people who work for insurers, medical professionals. That was something that we asked her about specifically during the forum. So I will be very curious to see how she addresses that transition plan once we get more details on that.
Another thing worth mentioning with respect to the Warren campaign is that her campaign signed on to a challenge to New Hampshire's controversial residency law, HB 1264. And here is Elizabeth Warren speaking during the forum on that residency law.
College students keep coming up to us and saying, I'd like to be engaged in this campaign. I really want to be able to vote in the primary. Can I? I don't know the rules. What are the rules? Am I in? Am I out? Do I have to go register somewhere else? Do I register here? If I register my car, is that what will make the difference? What does it take? So we're here to say two things. Principle, everybody ought to be able to vote. But the second part is to say we have evidence that it's causing great deal of confusion. And when you've got confusion, you suppress voting.
So HB 1264, just to clarify, merges the definition of domicile and residency so that college students from out of state would have to register their cars. And some have called that a poll tax.
That's actually a question that's at the center of an ongoing lawsuit that has not been formally resolved yet.
So that's the open question
right.
That she's referring to.
Right.
Yeah.
So I, a number of other reporters have tried to ask relevant state agencies for just a clear yes or no, or a clear explanation of what this law actually changes in practice for people with regard to vehicle licensing and registration. We've not gotten clear answers on that. The state has offered some arguments in court explaining how they view this law will be interpreted. But there's actually, as I said, open questions of fact that may end up being actually referred back down to the state Supreme Court. Right now, this is a federal case, so it's a question of constitutionality. But the judge overseeing the case has said that there are some underlying issues that he needs to resolve that can really be best resolved at the state level. So there's that's kind of a long-winded way of saying that this is really complicated and that there's not a lot of clarity on where this legal challenge will go moving forward or on what exactly this new law will mean for voters and for people in particular who may be transient, like out-of-state college students.
But Dean, really quickly, yes. It seems to suggest how important college students are as a voting bloc for the Warren campaign.
For Democrats in general, you look at the voting trends in college towns like Durham or Hanover or even Manchester, Keene, Plymouth, et cetera, a big source of votes for Democrats. And, right now, as Casey was saying, this is in federal court, an issue of constitutionality. Is this a poll tax making them register cars or get driver's licenses? Are they being disenfranchised because 18-year-olds are allowed to vote, but they often go to college? So how do you deal with that? And basically, the ACLU is asking the federal court to pause the the bill, the law, and then go to the state Supreme Court for a special certification to look into some of these issues about enforcement, et cetera. So have greater clarity. And I believe there is going to be another hearing on this. The federal judge is still deciding. I think there's going to be another hearing in a week or two.
And really quickly, before we move on to the Manchester mayoral race, Casey, Tom Steyer, the billionaire businessman, came by NHPR as well for a candidate forum. The full thing, full interview at NHPR.org. But what was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, well, it was a busy week in Studio D this week where we have these forums. But I found it actually most interesting that at one point I asked Tom Steyer about, you know, how are you going to bridge the divide with people you disagree with, in particular when, you know, you've been involved in a lot of political groups that have been very active in campaigning and running ads against Republicans. And in the forum, Steyer said, we haven't been running ads. He said that NextGen focused on grassroots organizing. We had a little bit of a follow-up on that. But I do think that it's just worth noting that, you know, the data and Steyer's own, NextGen's own records just contradict that. Open Secrets, which tracks money in politics, shows that NextGen spent more than $600,000 on communications and coordinated expenses against Republican candidates in 2018, more than $5 million in 2016, more than $18 million this cycle before. And, you know, I went back in my own email archive after the forum just to kind of gut check and found press releases from NextGen touting the ads that they were running against Republicans. So I think that's just a point that's worth stressing, that despite what Steyer said at the time, that he has a track record, of the groups that he's founded have a track record of campaigning against Republicans.
Well, again, listeners, we've got all of these conversations, at the full conversations at NHPR.org. Please do check them out there if you're interested. And NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much for joining us for this part of the program. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
And listeners, just a reminder that our candidate forum series continues next week with Andrew Yang. He'll be visiting the studios on Thursday, November 7th. You can listen live at 9 o'clock and send your questions ahead of time now to exchange@nhpr.org. I want to move on to the Manchester mayoral race with NHPR's Sarah Gibson. Sarah, thank you very much for being in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
So incumbent Mayor Joyce Craig and challenger Republican former state representative Victoria Sullivan, she was here. They were both here this week. You were listening in on the debate. What was your takeaway?
Well, I think it wasn't entirely different from the other debates they've had, and they stuck both to their messages. For Mayor Craig, that is a message that she has brought economic development to Manchester, that she has supported the public schools and increased funding to the public schools of the city, and that she will continue tackling the complex issue of public safety in the city. And Sullivan says she's going to take back Manchester. She's going to respect the tax cap, which has been overridden multiple times. And she also stuck to the central platform of her campaign, which is that Manchester is becoming a less safe city to live in. There are quality of life and public safety concerns that Mayor Craig has not paid attention to.
Addressing the issue of homelessness was something both candidates wanted to do in this debate, and they've talked about it in others. What do these candidates want to do about it?
Well, the want to do in the future is a kind of interesting question, because really Craig defended her record. She didn't talk a ton about what she's going to do in the future as much as what she has done in the last 2 years. She talked a lot about spending more resources on making sure that people stay in the homes that they already have. So basically making sure there aren't more homeless people by supporting affordable housing initiatives. She said they'd continue to work with state agencies and, touted having a homeless prevention and response coordinator, and it's kind of coordinating more at the city level to help address what is, certainly a major increase in homelessness in the city. Sullivan said that's not really a plan. You don't have a plan for homelessness. She said that she would empower nonprofits, particularly the faith community, to kind of spearhead efforts to address homelessness in the city. She's also said that she wants to majorly reform safe stations. Safe stations are the places in the fire stations in Manchester that people are coming to for help with substance use disorder. And basically, Sullivan believes that Manchester should be billing towns that are the towns of origin or the homes of origin of people who end up at the safe station, so that Manchester isn't having to have all that burden on its shoulders. However, there are questions about how that actually could happen, but that's certainly the reforming of safe stations is pretty a pretty large part of her plan to combat homelessness.
And on the subject of education, there was quite a bit of time spent on education policy too. The candidates said essentially, Joyce Craig was saying that, well, I could start with Victoria Sullivan, who said that a citywide curriculum would be a top priority for the money that's coming down from the state. Joyce Craig was saying, you know, it would be great, but it really is costly to have a citywide curriculum. And in any case, the teacher-student ratio is the most important thing to her. And what's your take on their education policies?
Well, so this is technically a nonpartisan election in Manchester, but really, both candidates have positions on education that very much reflect their political parties. So Craig really does believe that funding and sending more resources to schools is a central part of how to reform and improve the education, the public education system in Manchester. And you'll hear from Sullivan that, you know, the biggest problem for Manchester schools is not funding. It's not getting more resources. It's spending those resources more responsibly. And she said really the biggest problem was the school board. She said they're kind of the main hurdle that Manchester needs to get over in order to improve its public schools. So I think that kind of focus on personnel as opposed to funding, I mean, that's a you know, a debate you see in the state house and among lawmakers, you know, over this larger question of education and whether or not it will be improved through increased resources.
Well, this debate we had on Monday, it touched on a variety of subjects. I wish we could debrief with you on all of them right now, Sarah, but we're running out of time. But I did want to thank you very much for providing your insight into the Manchester mayoral race. Thank you very much.
Sure. You're welcome.
That's NHPR's Sarah Gibson. And still to come on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we're actually going to preview the latest episode of Strangled. Stranglehold, NHPR's podcast looking at the history, future, and relevance of the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary. So that's coming up on The Exchange, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And for this part of the program, we'd like to offer you a bit of one of NHPR's many podcasts, Stranglehold, which looks at the history, relevance, and traditions of the First in the Nation New Hampshire primary. The most recent episode of Stranglehold, featuring NHPR's Lauren Chulgin and reporter Jason Moon, starting out at the John McCain 2007 town hall held at the World War II Museum, and a question from a member of the audience.
Good evening, Senator. Today, unfortunately, I wear a black bracelet in memory of my son who lost his life in Baghdad. I would like to know, sir, if you would wear this so that you could remember your mission and their mission in support of them.
I would be honored.
Thank you, sir.
I'm grateful.
Thank you, sir.
Someone in the audience that day told me McCain's reaction felt so authentic, and you can see it if you watch the C-SPAN video of this event. He's very emotional.
May I ask how old Matthew was? 22. Thank you for his service. Yes, ma'am, I will wear this. Thank you.
And John McCain actually wore that bracelet until the day he died. And so this story, it gets held up around here as this like perfect unscripted moment between a candidate and a normal New Hampshire voter. The takeaway from these stories was, look what New Hampshire can offer. We are a place where these real unscripted moments can happen. Our voters can reveal unique perspectives on political leaders, potential leaders of the free world. But that leaves me wondering, is that still the case? Jason Moon is actually where I got this whole idea from. He's a reporter here at NHPR. He's been out on the trail lately, and he told me he's been seeing something different, something that makes him think, are these authentic moments really still possible? So, Jason.
Yes, Lauren.
I don't think we can really start this without defining for people what bird dogging is.
Right. So bird dogging is something we see a fair share of here in New Hampshire with the presidential primary and all the candidates that come by. But it's not unique to the primary. Certainly, it happens in politics everywhere. And basically, it's when a voter comes to an event prepared.
Hi, I'm Allison. I'm with Rights and Democracy New Hampshire. And as a young voter, one of my major concerns is climate change.
It's kind of like a professional question asking of candidates.
Will you take the no fossil fuel money pledge and do this with us?
But that can mean a lot of things. It can mean, you know, just a voter who, like, really knows what they want to ask and does it everywhere.
It's a simple one-sentence pledge to refuse any donations by fossil fuel companies or executives.
Or it can be like a paid staffer at an advocacy group. And so to them, the town hall is like a great way to get access to these candidates and to get their issues out in front of all the TV cameras and all the voters and the candidate themselves. It's not like what we think of maybe as like the typical voter who's like, oh, I'm just running to this event after work. Maybe I think of a question on the way there, or maybe you don't think of a question at all.
You also had kind of a, what shall we say, behind the, I don't know, a good hunting metaphor, behind the curtain. That's not hunting at all, but you got to peek behind the curtain at how bird dogging works. Please enlighten us.
Yes. So several months back, I got a chance to witness some of that preparation, to see bird dogging training. It was in this little office conference room type space. There was maybe a dozen people sitting in the circle of folding chairs.
Yeah, what kind of people do this training?
Well, it was an interesting mix from what I could tell, kind of all age ranges. One person was a state rep. You know, another person looked like they were maybe, you know, in their 20s. And they all kind of had like, here's what I think I would want to ask a candidate about, but they wanted to kind of workshop their questions and figure out, like, how do I really get the most out of seeing so-and-so at a town hall?
We have just a really, really incredible opportunity this year to change the narrative by getting up close and personal with these candidates.
I'm sorry, change the narrative?
Yeah, that's the name of the game here, Lauren. I mean, this training is being led by two people from a group called Rights and Democracy. They're
okay.
A liberal activist group, advocacy group here in New Hampshire. And basically what they're teaching people here is how to deconstruct the town hall and then kind of reverse engineer it for your own aims.
How do they do that?
Well, they role play and they act it out. So they even have like a fake candidate comes by for the training.
No.
Oh, here he is. Here he is, everyone. Roosevelt Abraham.
Hi.
Oh, yeah. Gives a stump speech and everything.
And actually, my second cousin's third wife's son is from Manchester. So
what?
Coming here, I really feel like I'm coming home.
And then he takes questions from the trainees and easily wiggles out of their questions because, you know, they haven't been trained yet. So they don't know how to ask a good bird dog question. Not yet.
Yes, how do you feel about Medicare for All?
I think Medicare for All is crucial. I think, of course, we all need health care. Thank you so much for your question. Other questions?
I'd like to follow up.
Just want to make sure we can hear from everyone, but thank you, ma'am.
And then they get down to workshopping their questions, how to do this better.
So what do you think makes a good bird dog question?
Specific questions would be a good...
Specific questions. So
the more specific, the better. The more specific your question is...
Do I know how to spell concise?
The harder it is for a candidate to wiggle out of answering it. And if they do wiggle out of it, if your question is, you know, tell me yes or no and then tell me why, and they don't do that, then everyone in the audience is going to have the same thought you just did. They didn't answer that question.
They even do fake interviews with fake reporters. So they handed out these like dry erase markers. They split the group into two lines, and you know, one line was the reporters and one line was the voters, and they like practiced how to talk about the candidate they had just seen to the reporter.
What are the markers for?
No, the markers are the microphones.
I worked on kind of a soundbite because I'm really concerned about disability rights.
Okay.
So in general, I like to say disability rights are human rights because it's true and it's striking and hopefully it's something that people will remember.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Mm-hmm. That's memorable. So anybody else remember, have a memorable soundbite that they heard?
And then, of course, I'm there with the microphone.
Oh, so meta.
For the, yes.
Yeah, wait, so you're there recording them practicing how to be recorded by a reporter. I mean, what was your observation of all this? Like, did you feel like you were being, I don't know, cheated in a way? People were practicing how to talk to you?
Well, in that moment, I was more happy than anything that I was able to see this because you have a sense that this stuff is happening and you know that both campaigns and activists, they're trained, they prepare, the way they talk to media is a whole different way. But just to be able to be in the room and to see this playing out and to hear them talk so openly and earnestly about what they were doing, there's no shame to it.
Elizabeth Warren is doing raffle tickets for questions. So the whole thing about being up front and center and raising your hand doesn't really matter when they do that. But if you go with a bunch of people and you get a whole bunch of people to get raffle tickets, and then you all give them to like one person who really wants to ask a question, or they have, you know, like you can take turns, that can be another way to just try to increase the odds that you will get be able to get called on.
Just get tickets. I mean, there are ways to manipulate, you know, manipulate the manipulation.
Basically, the feeling in this room is that they're tired of feeling like they're manipulated at presidential candidate events. You know, the candidate comes and gives a stump speech, and maybe someone asks them some questions, but, you know, they pivot out of it and switch, get back to the things they want to talk about, and maybe don't answer the tough questions. And, you know, the people in this room, their feeling is, wait a minute, the town hall, it's supposed to be for us, right? It's supposed to be our chance to meet the candidate, vet the candidate, ask them the tough questions. And it's gotten so airbrushed by the campaigns and the candidates that they've decided, you know, we need to up our game to match their game. So if they're going to manipulate, well, we're going to do the same thing.
Yeah, it's just so funny because maybe you've also had this experience. Like, as a reporter, I mean, when I see these people coming up to the mic and they say, you know, I'm from so-and-so advocacy group, I don't take as serious notes because I feel like it just doesn't feel as authentic to me.
Well, yeah, it can feel very inauthentic. And a lot of times that doesn't get acknowledged in the room.
Mm-hmm.
There's this dance going on and everyone kind of knows it, but no one tips their hat to it. But occasionally candidates will call it out. I was at an Amy Klobuchar event a couple months back, and she started to get bird dog.
So coming from a legal background, you understand perhaps more than other candidates what Trump is doing to our courts.
This guy is like sitting in this folding chair outside under this big tree, and he starts asking Amy Klobuchar about the Supreme Court and whether she would consider adding seats to it, something like that. And he is like filming her with his phone, like he's holding his phone up like just beneath his face as he's asking the question, which, you know, right away is not like the way humans talk to each other.
And since you're recording me for someone, hi person that's trying to get me on tape, how are you? Thanks for sending your guy to two events, but I called on him anyway.
So I went to this training. I saw the bird doggers like getting ready, like sharpening their knives for the candidates. You know, then I'm out at these campaign events. I'm seeing, you know, instances here and there of bird dogging. I'm seeing candidates call out bird doggers. And I'm just kind of fascinated by the whole thing. And but I wanted to get a sense of like, is it totally ruining town halls for like, quote unquote, normal voters? Or, you know, what are other people thinking about it?
You went to see Vice President Biden when he was in New Hampshire recently.
So I went with our colleague, Josh Rogers. So we go to this Joe Biden event, and we kind of set up our gear for the speech and then start chatting with voters. And the first woman we talked to, she's sitting up, you know, up close, like she got here early for the event.
What brings you here?
I'm here to see all the candidates.
Yeah.
This is my second time seeing Biden.
And what's her name?
Kathy Hoey.
I'm a Democrat, but I saw all the Republicans pretty much last time. Then they are here because they're here, and it's the thing to do when you're here if you enjoy politics, which I do.
You know, since she had been to all these events and had seen all these candidates, I thought perfect person to ask about bird dogging because she's probably seen it. And sure enough, she has.
I know the Alzheimer's lady and the HIV lady and the gun guy. And
which I just love because, like, so do I, right? But the more we talked about it, the more I asked her about it, she didn't have a problem with it. You know, I asked her, like, do you get tired of hearing the same questions again and again? She's like, no, it's good to get them on the record, to get them on the record early. Because some people might say, well, like, you know, leave it to, like, quote-unquote normal people to ask their questions, and leave these people come from
advocacy. They're normal people, too. They just are invested in the process more than other people might be. But they're just as normal, and they represent, I think, a constituency of their own, which is great.
So she really sees the value in it. And I thought that was really interesting that here she was, someone who's like really connected to these events, going to lots of them, is well aware of the bird dogging phenomenon, but has no problem with it. Is not cynical about it being fake or false or phony or anything like that. She just sees it as like a good, healthy part of the process. eventually Josh asked her if she was affiliated with any particular organization.
So you were affiliated with any advocacy group?
I can't really say.
What do you mean you can't really say?
No, because I've talked too much about it. But I am really here for myself and doing what I'm doing.
Okay, but I would take that as a yes.
Oh,
I see you winking.
Yeah, bird dogger right in front of us. That's the thing. You can't spot him until it's too late. Like, you go into a room, you don't know, like, which of these people are, like,
quote-unquote regular people or not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's hard to know, right?
Okay, so what are the details that you're looking for to try and suss them out?
Well, one thing I did notice, sitting near the back, handful of younger people, they just don't seem that interested. Hint number one, dead giveaway. Sure enough, Joe Biden starts speaking.
Working on the front lines against the battle of climate change.
So this is like a demonstration. This is like bird dogging, like turned up to 11, because they are not just here to like ask Joe Biden a tough question. They are here to disrupt.
Joe Biden, our planet is dying.
And then they get the rest of the audience, led by the firefighters, they have like a counter chant. The Biden staff comes and they're like kind of like ushering them out of the room, like, yeah, like, great, you had your moment, like, get out. So I'm immediately like, I gotta follow these people. I gotta talk to them about bird dogging and what they're doing, because this is all I can think about.
Which side are you on now? Which side are you on?
You guys, this is private.
And I start to try to interview some of these activists, and like, as soon as we started talking, like, all I could think about was the training. It was like, here it is. Like, these people are, like, using all of the tricks. For instance, nearly every question got back around with their answer to the idea that they needed a climate champion.
We're here because we need Joe Biden to be a climate champion, and he won't even talk about the issue.
They were prepared. That was the soundbite. Again, that reverse engineering of the process. They knew their reporter would come talk to them, and they wanted to have control over what part of what they said would end up in the story that would be at the end of this process.
Well, some people might take issue with tactics, like, you know, interrupting an event like that. What would you say to them?
So Joe Biden is kind of notoriously known for kind of not answering our questions, and we have asked questions over and over again. He either has denied our request or denied our ask, or he just doesn't give a clear-cut answer. So this is our last resort, but it is necessary for everyone to understand that this is the fight for our lives.
You know, there's two ways to see it. You can see the bird doggers preparing and coming up with their sound bites and planning everything, and see that as very invented and not spontaneous, and that's true. But there's also something real about the fact that these people feel so passionate about these issues that they're willing to go through all that trouble, you know, to go to a training event and practice with a mock candidate, or to go to a Joe Biden event and interrupt a former vice president of the United States and get shouted down by hundreds of people. You know, there's passion behind that. So there's something real at the root of that. The way they're going about expressing that can feel, and arguably is, quite manufactured. But you could say the exact same thing about what's happening on the other side of the equation, with the candidates and the campaigns. The candidate might, ex-presidential candidate, deep down, might really want to be president for all the right reasons. But they're still giving the same stump speech they've given 50,000 other times. And if for 5 minutes they're giving the stump speech and they're like on autopilot and they don't really realize what they're saying, I mean, you better believe that happens. But it's still the way we do it. So it's up to each person to decide, right? It's what is authentic to you? What is the authentic experience to you?
That's the latest from NHPR's new podcast, Stranglehold, about the First in the Nation primary. You can find it Wherever you get your podcasts, just search for Stranglehold. And that's it for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I want to thank Dean Spiliotis for being here on the program today. Dean, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
And really quick, Dean, what are you looking for next week news-wise? What will you be watching?
We're going to be watching the continuation of the filing period. The window is now open. Going to be a parade of candidates coming through, filing, having rallies, and so opportunity there to get a better sense of how they see New Hampshire fitting into their campaign plans. And then the other thing is looking at kind of the fallout from what we just saw yesterday with the impeachment vote in the House.
All right, Dean, thank you very much. We really appreciate you being on the program today. And we're going to close the show today with a different kind of music. Seacoast-based band The Soggy Po'Boys released a new album this week, all with interpretations of New Orleans jazz classics. This one, Ain't My Fault, originally written by Smokey Johnson. You'll find my interview with Stu Diaz of The Soggy Po'Boys at nhpr.org. This show was the fault of me and producers Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Rebecca Lavoie was working the cameras and our regular theme music by Bob Lord. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The stories we discussed today on nhpr.org. And of course, the conversation continues online and on Facebook. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.